are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, November 26, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Andrew Marantz, writer for The New Yorker and author of Antisocial, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. Also on the program today, federal court rules that Don McGahn must testify and answer congressional subpoena, but of course, McGahn appeals. However, this will start an onslaught of legal filings to get the Trump administration to provide a lot more. Meanwhile, SCOTUS temporarily stays access to Trump's financial records, and federal subpoenas are issued to probe Rudy Giuliani's businesses for potential money laundering, obstruction of justice, and campaign finance laws violations. Meanwhile, a federal court in Michigan finds that Michigan's Independent Districting Commission can move forward in drawing 2020 maps. Big deal. That's not facetious. Meanwhile, Trump wants the war criminals he pardoned to campaign with him.
Nothing paramilitary at all.
Betsy DeVos to issue new rules to protect potential sexual assaulters on campus. And Virginia Governor Northam signals he's not interested in rolling back Virginia's anti-union laws, even though fully controlled by Democrats now. Sanders calls on Major League Baseball to reverse its plan to close 25% of the minor league teams. And Joe Biden's liaison to Latino, African-American, and women's groups quits because she was working for Joe Biden.
And I could be a fly on that wall.
Indeed. Well, I think that's the problem.
Go work for someone else. Fine.
I think that's the problem. That's what they were basically had relegated.
You want to be put on someone else's website? Fine.
Oh, forgive me, Father.
Yeah, forgive me.
Kentucky Republicans to pull the North Carolina stunt and try to strip a newly elected Democratic governor of the governor's power. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. We got a lot of things to get to. We have two more days for our broadcast week. We will be taking mostly calls tomorrow and getting to some news stories, particularly a talk. Well, one of the things we'll touch on is obviously all these legal cases that are going forward. They're going to have implications in a myriad of different ways. And we will also talk about the a speech that Brett Kavanaugh gave that indicates the regulatory system that we have in this country, as we know it from the federal government, is in serious jeopardy. And so keep this in mind, regardless of what we talk about on the context of the 2020 campaign. The Supreme Court has the ability to stymie a lot of things, maybe not permanently. I mean, we've seen in the past where the Supreme Court has been overcome over the course of a decade or so, although they were well entrenched for decades, stymieing all sorts of political reforms. And it's quite possible we're going to be heading into a sort of another Lochner era, as it were, But we will talk about that more tomorrow. Also, just a reminder, AM Quickie available. You can sign up for it at amquickie.com. And also, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. There's a little bit of like the Empire Strikes Back quality to the Democratic primary that's happening now. Barack Obama claims that he was misinterpreted in that New York Times article where he talked about how you shouldn't be way out there trying to get all sorts of different stuff. I think the first piece that was written about it, I think, sort of mischaracterized it. But the second one, which was, I think, gave a little more clarity, I think was just as problematic. And now there's a piece in Politico talking about his desire to step on, here it is, about Barack Obama, that he's been hanging back, but back when Sanders seemed like more of a threat than he does now, Obama said privately that if Bernie were running away with the nomination, Obama would speak up to stop him. That's very sweet of him.
A threat to what, I want to know?
Well, I think he seemed like more of a threat in terms of electorally. Now,
he's a disciple of Farrakhan. This is anti-Semitism. I'm learning my Warren techniques right now.
And you know, we'll talk about Bloomberg. I'm not we will talk about Bloomberg later in the program, but I'm not quite convinced that that isn't part of Bloomberg's agenda. I mean, usually you go into these situations and it's never about necessarily one thing. You assess various different scenarios, and if the majority of them work out, at least in as you perceive as a net positive, then maybe you do something. So I think Mike Bloomberg has sort of like multi-tiered reasons for entering the race, of course, starting with his ego. But here's another guy who's back from the dead, and talk about a smooth forehead controversy. Here is Rahm Emanuel.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He is on ABC's This Week. And he is there to be the voice of the most hated man in the Democratic Party. I really don't know that there is. Well, I think that's probably an overstatement. By the most hated man, perhaps by the left wing of the Democratic Party. From day one, this guy saw it as his job as stymieing progressives' influence within the Obama administration and upon the Obama administration. And so, of course, he's the one who comes and speaks for Democrats. And really mischaracterizes, I think, the entire Democratic Party project since the early 20th century. Here is Rahm Emanuel.
Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders' credit. They brought their A-game to the policy debate. There is a history from the New Deal to the New Frontier to the New Covenant, President Clinton, to the One America under President Obama, of respecting the value of work, shared responsibility, equal access to opportunity. And the fact is, free income, free college, guaranteed health care has walked away from the traditional value system that Democrats, the traditional liberal system, going from Roosevelt backward, look. Social Security, payroll tax. Medicare, payroll tax. Earned income tax credit is based on work. AmeriCorps under President Clinton is value of service to country. And that traditional argument, both Deval Patrick, Mike Bloomberg, and Barack Obama, notice, have not spoken up, and all the other candidates have got to bring their A game, like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have, to the policy debate.
Yeah, this is stunning. First of all, this is a total fabrication. You can go back. There's a speech by John Kennedy about the idea of Medicare for all. You can go back to Truman era when they were trying to get a Medicare for all. I don't know if they called it Medicare for all, but health care for everyone. This is just absurd. The idea that free college is sort of some type of new idea. Go ask your parents. Go ask their parents about
CUNY
free university.
Was free until very recently.
You had it in many, many states around the country, and state colleges were always, always heavily discounted, if not free.
FDR, the third of the four freedoms is freedom from want.
I mean,
globally, by the way, not in that speech, not even just the United States, everywhere.
The idea.
Harvey K would throttle Rahm Emanuel.
I mean, but really, any full on Democrat should throttle him. The idea that the earned income tax is part of Democratic values, it was a Republican plan adopted by his boss. This is just bizarre. It's bizarro world. I don't know what George Stephanopoulos did after that, but I'm quite sure he didn't push back on it. Maybe Chris Christie stood up and said, "No, well, wait a second. That's not right, Rahm." But it's just bizarre. It's bizarre the lengths in which they're going to go. And so there's a lot more coming forward with this. And, you know, when I look at like... You know, we have questions like, why is Deval Patrick? And we talked about this with Perrine on Friday. Why is Deval Patrick in the race? Why is Mike Bloomberg in the race? I think a lot of it is as much for them to win the nomination, or perhaps even more than for them to win the nomination, than to prevent the most left candidates in the race from winning. I mean, I think that's just basically the reality. And what's also interesting here is, and I guess maybe this can be taken as a positive, you're not hearing as much as we have in the past. They can't win in the general. And
yeah, because they have no data to support that.
That's true. And I think it's not just that they have no data to support it, that there's like overwhelming understanding that that's not the case. Because even if they didn't have data, they would still sort of float that idea. But they know they can't. And so they're actually going to try and rewrite the entire history of the Democratic Party and say that it's inconsistent with the Democratic Party to provide a free option of higher education, or to provide government supported health insurance. I mean, this is just bizarre. It's bizarre. And
it relies on people having a very short historical memory.
Yes. And that is actually a fairly decent bet to make. Folks, it's a lot of people starting to, you know, gear up for their Hanukkah and Christmas shopping. Well, apparently now there is a new concern online when you do some online shopping. We're now hearing about e-skimming. Apparently that's when online criminals, cyber criminals, they watch online shopping carts in order to steal credit card and debit card information from websites and mobile apps. Other information captured includes names, date of birth, account numbers, passwords, and location. Now, not everybody can do what I do, which is have 14 different email addresses and a series of rotating passwords so that if someone found the password for one email, they couldn't possibly figure out what to do with it. But targeted businesses...
End up booking your shows by accident.
Yeah, not everybody else wants to go around...
Going
yeah,
live
exactly.
on YouTube.
Not exactly.
Can you email Adam Green, hacker?
Targeted businesses include retailers, ticket selling sites, travel-related companies, and more. Every time you bank, every time you browse online, you're vulnerable to cyber criminals, or at least you can be. And you've heard me talk about LifeLock. They were a pioneer in identity theft protection. Now Norton, which was a pioneer in consumer cybersecurity back in the day, they've joined forces, LifeLock and Norton, to help protect your cyber safety. A Norton 360 with LifeLock membership provides an all-in-one protection with device security, identity theft protection, a VPN for online privacy, and more. If there's an identity theft problem, they have specialists who will work to fix it. No one can prevent all cybercrime. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. But Norton 360 with LifeLock, it's going to be a powerful ally for your cyber safety. Until December 8th, sign up and get a special offer. You can save up to 40% off your first year by going to norton.com/majority. That's 40% off your first year by going to Norton.com/majority. That's 40% off Norton 360 with LifeLock at Norton.com/majority. And one of today's sponsors is News Voice. It's the first ever entirely open, crowdsourced, and democratized platform for news. And you can download the app for free at newsvoice.com/majority. Look, the vast majority of news owned by the same five huge corporations. It is important for us to always pay attention to where our news is coming from, who owns which media outlets, what predispositions they have, what political biases may be in play, what corporate interests they may have. And that's exactly what News Voice helps you keep track of. News Voice is a free crowdsourced website and mobile app that lets you create personalized news feeds and maintain a clear picture of where your news is coming from and what political slants may exist. It helps you aggregate news from corporate outlets, international outlets, local news, and independent media, giving you access to every side of every story. News Voice is fueled by its community users. They contribute, they fact check, they submit stories, sources that are missing, they upvote stories, they write story summaries. You can also comment on stories and you can debate politics with other members of the community. Through staying active in the community, you can level up, you earn more perks on the platform. The News Voice Play feature lets you listen to your personal news feed every day. And they do so through their customizable audio news playlist. It's your own personally tailored radio station for news. News Voice is a next generation news aggregator and social media platform that values transparency, good journalism, and productive political discussions. Get totally free access by going to newsvoice.com/majority. I put a link underneath this video. If you're watching on YouTube or if you're listening to the podcast, it'll be in the podcast description as always. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be talking to a staff writer from The New Yorker, Andrew Marantz, on his book, Antisocial. Let me even tease this a little better. The guy spent a considerable amount of time with our buddy, Mike Cernovich.
Who's laughing now, Sam?
Wow, that's pretty good. Of course, that is going to be a topic of our conversation, among others. In fact, the folks that he spent time with, I don't want to say this is an ethnography, but it is partly, is like a who's who of people that we mock on a daily basis here. So it's
wait, is Ruben in it?
No, darn. No, this is more a little bit less of the launderers and a little bit more of the actual. Full-on, I don't know what we'd
use. I'm a launderer?
Yeah.
I guess I launder things.
Literally. Antisocial online extremists, techno-utopians, and the hijacking of the American conversation. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program New Yorker staff writer Andrew Marantz on his book, Antisocial, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks. Good to be here.
I got to say, now this is sort of exciting for me because we are almost a year to the day. Maybe it's a year to 2 days when Mike Cernovich got me fired from or started the ball rolling on getting me fired from MSNBC. He ultimately failed or he succeeded and then got rehired. But so it's fun for me to talk to you at this time and remember that holiday in my own personal life. But all right. So first off, you start at the deplorable. And the thing that excites me about, at least, you know, a part of what you've done here is it acknowledges something that I think justifies part of what we do here, which is, you know, cover a lot of these same folks. Give me a sense of why you decided to sort of immerse yourself in that world. I mean, obviously you did so as a reporter and now as an author, but why?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, I was conflicted about it ethically and, you know, you never want to give bad people more attention than they deserve. So I didn't want to, you know, just give people attention just for the sake of it. I wanted to, you know, use it as a test case for what the internet could do to us as a society. So, yeah, I didn't want to just go to the deepest, darkest ranges of the internet and just say, what kind of specimens do we have here? And, you know, just hold them up to the light just for the sake of it. I wanted to show, okay, if the internet is built the way it's built, what is that doing to us as a society? And I, because of, you know, the style of reporting I like to do, I wanted to be around people for a long time and see them as examples of how bad our information ecosystem had become. And they were willing to show me.
And so, I mean, to be clear, so you're saying that the idea was, I want to see what the, I want to spend some time with the input so that I can see what the machine looks like.
Yeah, exactly. And I, sorry, am I cutting in and out on your end, the sound?
No, you sound good to us.
All right, cool. All right, excellent. So basically, yeah, I wanted to see from both angles. I mean, so the subtitle is Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation, right? So I wanted to see from the tech platform point of view and from the disrupt, you know, I mean, it's funny because they both call themselves disruptors, right? But I wanted to see from the tech platform's point of view and also from the people, you know, the bigots and trolls and propagandists and whoever who were using the platforms so successfully. You know, there was this kind of, for the first few years of social media, there was this kind of legend, this kind of halo effect that, you know, all that will come from social media is nice things, you know, Arab Spring and democratic revolutions and, you know, social justice and all the rest of it. And this worked to the benefit of these huge megalith corporations that could just sort of say, well, you know, don't worry about anything we do. We're just going to sort of let it all hang out and it'll all ultimately redound to the good and the arc of history will just naturally bend toward justice. And I think around 2014, 2015, you know, a few of us could really see that that wasn't quite how things were panning out exclusively. I mean, it was in part, but certainly not exclusively. And so I wanted to kind of see it from both sides, from the, you know, by embedding in a lot of the companies. I spent a lot of time at the offices of Reddit and some time at the other big companies. But I also wanted to see it from the people like, you know, the deplorables themselves, who were very consciously, concertedly setting out to unravel the fabric of our democracy in many ways. I mean, that isn't quite how they would put it, but that's in effect what they were doing. And so, you know, I just sort of said, hey, I'm a journalist. I want to be a fly on the wall and watch you do this stuff. And, you know, some people said no. I mean, Alex Jones said yes and then got cold feet. I mean, there are a lot of examples of people who changed their minds or thought better of it. But most of the people said, yeah, come on in. And I was kind of surprised by that. But I also thought, you know, they're not breaking the rules of these platforms. They're not like Russian state actors. They're not breaking any laws. They're not using any illegal campaign funds to a large extent. I mean, they do sometimes break laws, which we can get into, but for the most part, they're just doing exactly what the platforms are incentivizing them to do, and they're doing it extremely well. So I, you know, spent 3 or 4 years documenting what they were doing. And to your question earlier, sometimes I felt a little transactional about it. Like I worried that they were using me to get more attention or more kind of legitimacy. And that was a constant ethical tug of war that I was working out with myself. But I felt that it was just important to document what they were doing, because if we don't know what they're doing, they can just keep doing it and nobody's even tracking it.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, having started my career, and at least in the context of this type of work in AM talk radio, the idea of how much of light we were shining on Rush Limbaugh. Are we letting him, you know, blossom, or is it hurting him? I think ultimately it's the only way to deal with this problem. And then one of the advantages I think I have is that I have not the credibility to give a platform to someone like this in the same way that, frankly, the New Yorker is. So it's less of a dilemma, I think, in my mind, although I think that it's a tough nut to sort of crack. I think it also has to do with your approach on how you report on them. Right.
Like, yeah.
You know, in what context? I mean, frankly, there's a big difference in my mind between Barry Weiss sort of allowing to the narrative to be taken over by the IDW, let's say, like as if there's an intellectual dark web, versus sort of saying like, this is what this guy is doing and people can see the problems on it.
Yes. I think the manner in which you report on stuff is hugely important. And I think the tone of it, the context, how you frame it, these are all choices. I mean, people often make out to be a binary thing. You know, do you shine a light on dark things or do you not? And I just don't think the binary gets you very far. I mean, you know, just to take the most extreme example, you know, a lot of reporters have to report on ISIS and they don't sort of take it as a binary choice to say, well, should we report on ISIS or should we not report on ISIS? I think everybody would see that as a false choice. You know, you do it carefully. You try to do it without replicating ISIS propaganda in any kind of nefarious way. You try to, you know, keep hostages' names out of your reporting for their own safety. You know, you just take an array of ethical considerations in mind. And I think with this stuff, with the alt-right, with online bigotry, with trolling and all these things, it's a little more complicated, right? It's literally closer to home. It's a little more confusing. These people, as opposed to someone like an ISIS who's, you know, really championing how evil they are in a kind of like novel and shocking way. A lot of times what people in movements like, you know, a lot of neo-fascist movements will do is try to cloak themselves as normal or as the guy next door or, you know, just messing around and just in it for the lulls or whatever. And that, I think, puts an even higher onus on reporters to go in with a lot of nuance and a lot of complexity and not get tricked and not let their readers get tricked. And there's a whole array of ways that works. And I had to, you know, I had to study up because I really was worried about being used or getting it wrong. And there are a bunch of things I did to get up to speed. But one thing, you know, you were talking about the difference in what kind of platform you're giving someone. I think there's even a difference, you know, among quote unquote sort of mainstream legitimizing media where, you know, the New Yorker and the New York Times are different places. The New York Times has a specific kind of paper of record kind of voice. The New Yorker has its own voice, but it's not, you don't have to be as kind of studiously neutral in the same way. You can sort of say more of what you mean. Now, you're not going to come out like, you know, Gawker and just call someone, you know, some, you know, aspersion or some name in a way that doesn't feel grounded by the context. But if somebody does something stupid or racist, you can say in the text, I thought this was stupid or racist. And I did take the liberty of doing that. So I don't, you know, I didn't feel that I was in this trap with this book where I said, well, you know, I have to give equal voice to all sides and I have to just, you know, report the facts and there's nothing else I can do. And I think a lot of the people, you know, whether you're talking about, I mean, anyone in the book, you know, Gavin McInnes or, you know, James O'Keefe or any of the people, Mike Cernovich, and even down to the more just overt kind of anti-Semite Nazi people, they sort of, I don't know what they were thinking exactly, but I think they were partly just, you know, used to my presence because I was around so much. But I think they were also kind of thinking, well, look, you know, this guy doesn't make stuff up. He reports the facts. And as long as he doesn't quote us incorrectly, we'll probably be fine. And I don't know, maybe they weren't quite reckoning with the fact that I could also sort of layer my arguments and opinions in there. And, you know, that I wasn't just hampered by some kind of old fashioned notion that all I was allowed to do was quote their words and not offer my own analysis.
Well, I mean, and maybe we're getting a little bit ahead of myself, but I want to anyways. How, when you want to, like, because you sat down, and we should say, like, these people, and I think you acknowledge this, are sort of the, at least the intellectual disciples of Andrew Breitbart, or at least they're within that tradition where Breitbart's whole thing was politics are downstream from culture.
Right.
He was also a guy who had, as far as I could tell, no ideology, or at least no ideas that were about conservative policies beyond the fact that I think the cool kids wouldn't let him hang out with him in L.A. And he felt like he was shut out of the cool kids, you know, what he perceived liberal Hollywood elite. And that became sort of the bedrock of everything he did. This crew in some way are disciples of him, and others too, like Ben Shapiro, who doesn't get so much attention from you. But just speak to that for a moment. And then I want to ask you about whether whether these people are that, how much of it is that they are just so celebrity hungry that they're convinced that any press is good press, and they're not that concerned with you being there if you're not, you know, if you don't have an overt agenda.
Right. Well, so, well, you know, just to take Ben Shapiro, he was in part of that early Breitbart crew. And so, yeah, there, you know, part of it is I had to be selective. There are so many people that I could have gone down various paths with. And, you know, with people like Shapiro, there are a few other people like this in the book. You know, I really, because these people were, my goal was to illustrate how social media is specifically an accelerant of this stuff. I mean, the book is called Antisocial for a variety of reasons, but one is that, you know, it's really a book about what social media can do to us to kind of damage our social fabric, in addition to the pro-social things that it can do that everybody is more comfortable talking about. So when I encountered someone, and I think Ben Shapiro kind of falls into this category where, you know, they would have been doing their thing even if social media had never come along. You know, he just would have been doing talk radio, or, you know, and his message would have been the same. You know, he would have been going along, you know, with certain tenets of, you know, I love guns and I love religious freedom and whatever. And, you know, maybe the message would have been a little bit different because there wouldn't have been the same kind of incentives that social media algorithms are constantly giving us to spark as much emotion and rage and fear as possible. You know, maybe he wouldn't be, you know, shilling for gold in the same way, or maybe he wouldn't be, you know,
he would be, but yes, I know, but I know your point's well taken. I think the idea is, like, you're looking at animals who are specifically animals. You're looking at specifically people who are creatures of social media in some way. And
right,
where
exactly.
Social media is a but for in terms of their existence. All right. So let's talk about Mike Cernovich. You were sitting with him, if not, I think literally, when he developed the narrative that Hillary Clinton had Parkinson's or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Walk us through that.
Well, so these narratives, I mean, who knows where they are born in the great, you know, morass of the internet sort of collecting conscious. But I was sitting with him, you know, again, because these things are meant to be illustrative examples. I go into my sort of alighting at Cernovich's house in a chapter of the book that I call Reductio ad absurdum. So, you know, I know people love, you know, philosophy lectures, but I won't go too deep into it. But basically, a reductio ad absurdum is an example of something where, you know, if the premises had been true from the beginning, you would not have arrived at an absurd outcome, right? So there must be something wrong with the premises. So in this case, the premises that Zuckerberg and Dorsey and all the rest of us were giving were, we're the free speech wing of the free speech party. We're going to open everything up to everyone, and that will ultimately bring us all closer together and make the world more open and connected and change the world for the better. Those were their initial starting premises, and it just so happened that in the process they would accrue unparalleled power and wealth and all the rest of it. I wanted to show that those premises were wrong. And I didn't just want to, you know, go on a screed about it or have an opinion about it because, you know, everybody has opinions about the internet. I wanted to show, okay, who is someone who would not, and I think should not, have the kind of influence they do if not for the flawed and warped premises that we had been fed by the techno-utopian social media founders. And the perfect person I found to illustrate that, I think, was Mike Cernovich. So I went to his house in Orange County and just said, walk me through how you have as much influence as you have. And now...
You know, and temporally, in terms of his career, because he went from a guy who was a men's rights activist. I guess he was also like a pickup artist type of guy.
Pickup artist, yes, and a kind of freelance lawyer for the Gamergate movement. And I
and an anti-date rape activist. Like, he was an active date rape denialist.
Yeah, well, and so I go into a lot of this in the book because I think it's useful to know, you know, where people come from. He had a rape charge, I think, around the time of law school. You know, he's a lawyer. He graduated from law school, but he didn't get admitted to the bar for several years because of this rape charge. And he had a first marriage that ended up breaking up essentially because he was having his own kind of private, you know, anti-feminist awakening kind of red-pilling experience. And as that was happening, kind of as he was not really able to find work and he was kind of experiencing a lot of cognitive dissonance between blogging about how, you know, men need to be empowered and they can't be enslaved by, you know, the women and the feminist ideology of our times. He was also, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but his bills were being paid by his wife, who was a high powered tech employee.
So he got like a big chunk of that Facebook cash that she had.
So this is one of these things where if I had been writing a novel, I think my editor would have been like, all right, it's a little heavy handed to have, you know,
right,
your kind of tech social media anti-hero be, you know, literally, you know, bankrolled by someone from the Facebook IPO through a divorce. But, you know, it just so happens that it's true, and I got the court records to prove it. These are not, you know, things that people were handing to me because it's embarrassing. But yeah, I mean, this is a case study in how tied up in this people can be. How it could be, you know, the thing that is paying the bills and the thing that, you know, you've known. I mean, he claims, I think credibly, to have had dinner at Sheryl Sandberg's house, and, you know, met, you know, all the higher ups at Facebook through his wife. And then to go from that to essentially using these platforms to, you know, spark all kinds of little waves of, you know, lies and conspiracies and nihilism and, you know, retrograde politics. It's just a fascinating turn of events that, again, is in itself a demonstration of how flawed the principles of social media always were. So that all happens leading up to 2014-ish is when Gamergate happens. I wasn't tracking him then, but I went back and recreated all this stuff. And then when I encountered him was 2016, when it was really the run-up to the 2016 election. And as you mentioned, he really wanted Trump to win and Hillary to lose, partly, you know, to trigger the libs and to, you know, mess with the snowflakes and whatever, partly because he didn't want immigration into the country and he thought Trump would stop immigration. Another one of these great ironies is that his second wife is, you know, comes from Iranian descent, even though he is sort of a proud Islamophobe in many ways. So it's just a weird, I mean, people are just really, really weird and full of dark, scary contradictions, as becomes clear throughout my reporting on this stuff. So, you know, I said to him, hey, whenever I track one of these memes about Hillary is sick, or, you know, video footage of Hillary blinking gets interpreted as her having some kind of stroke, or, you know, just bizarre kind of rumors that, you know, people kind of hoping in a kind of freelance propaganda way would damage the Clinton campaign. Whenever I traced one of those things back, chances were that Cernovich had a hand in spreading it, if not inventing it, sometimes both. And this was pre-Pizzagate, but it was that kind of class of stuff. And so I just wrote to him and said, hey, it seems like, you know, you are really influential at spreading this stuff. And, you know, influential is a neutral word. It doesn't mean it's good or bad. I mean, in this case, right. It's bad. It just means it is having an influence on, you know, this massively, crucially important presidential election. And as you pointed out from the Andrew Breitbart dictum about politics being downstream from culture, you know, we might like to think, oh, people's votes are not going to be swayed by some weird random piece of internet detritus that they happen to see about how Hillary Clinton secretly has a neurological disorder. But we don't actually know that to be the case. That's just our hope. We just like hope and pray that people's brains won't be swayed by that stuff. But in fact, they often are. So all of which is to say, I sort of said, I want to see how you do this. And he says, yeah, sure, you know, come watch me do it. So I just go to his house, sit there for several days, and then, you know, tracked him for a couple of years off and on after that, and just watched how he did it. So, I mean, he would just sit at his, you know, little kitchen table and open up an iPad with a Periscope on it. He would start a Periscope and get, about 1,000, 2,000, you know, kind of his hardcore fans into the Periscope, and they would sort of workshop what the hashtag was going to be. I was going to say hashtag of the day, but they would do multiple ones per day. And it would be Hillary's coughing, or, you know, Hillary's bringing in terrorists, or whatever. I mean, there would, whatever the thing was that he thought would create an association, whether it was true or not true, that would make people afraid or fearful or feel some kind of disgust, any of these like visceral viral emotions. And they would pick a hashtag that they thought would trend. Then they would all swarm over to Twitter and get it trending. And again, none of this is against the rules, even though some people argue that it should be against the rules of Twitter to have a kind of coordinated campaign like that. And then once it's trending on Twitter, as you and your audience well know, then it kind of gives mainstream journalists permission to touch it. And it kind of made them feel like they have an obligation to cover it, because now it's, you know, it's trending. Now it's like a quote unquote objective, you know, thing that people are talking about. And from there, they could just kind of hijack the news cycle and go, okay, now that it's trending, we can get Drudge to talk about it, or we can get Fox News to talk about it. And then from Fox News, it can go to the other networks or whatever. Then it becomes a thing. And then it was basically like I would open the newspaper the next day and see a story and go, yeah, I'm pretty sure that story would not be in the newspaper if not for what I watched Cernovich and his cronies do yesterday.
Now, this pipeline, not dramatically different from what we saw like in the aughts, when you would have right-wing blogs do this, and that would get to Drudge, and then Drudge and then you had, you know, some producer at ABC starting their day every morning reading what Drudge says, and as soon as Drudge gives it an imprimatur, it becomes at least worthy of reporting. But let me ask you this: how much? Because there's two. I want to go in the direction of a little bit of sort of the platforms themselves, mm-hmm. but also about the I just want to stay with the MO of Cernovich. Like in my experience with him, I think he had Posobiec go through. I think he at one point he had said this to somebody in an interview, that he hired Posobiec to go through my Twitter feed, use the search term rape, found a tweet that I put out in 2009 slamming Roman Polanski. Really, actually, people who were apologizing for Roman Polanski by suggesting that. You know, if my daughter's ever raped, I hope it's by someone with a great sense of mise-en-scène, as a way of slamming these people. And he got Seb Gorka and Donald Trump Jr. to retweet it. And that was basically, it was off to the races at that point. But one of the things I also noticed was that a lot of the people who were retweeting it had no followers and were barely following people. And so, simultaneous to this, a buddy of mine just started doing, I don't know if it was on one of those like bot or not websites, and there was a lot of bots. Mm-hmm. And I wonder to what extent, A, you saw use of this technique, and B, how much, when we look at people like
Gavin McGinnis, when we look at people like, you know, even Laura Loomer or, you know, folks like Posobiec or Cernovich or Milo Yiannopoulos, how much were you aware or digging into funding sources? Because, yeah. I mean, like I more or less do what these people do on the right. I do this on the left. I mean, I'm not as deceitful and I don't lie. But, you know, if someone called me a propagandist, you know, at least with some of the work, I would say, well, I think that's, you know, in a value neutral term, that's correct. My growth would be much bigger than it is now if I was to receive, let's say, here's $300,000, Sam, 2 years ago, and you're going to buy ads or you're going to buy bots or you're going to do this. I wonder because, you know, Breitbart got $12 million invested right around the time before he died, that Bannon. And that site was not even remotely profitable at that time. You could just go on and you could just calculate the ads. There was no ads on that site when he got that investment. I'm quite sure it came from the Mercers in retrospect. But how much of that did you see that they were getting funding from anywhere?
Yeah. Well, and you know, the Mercers were careful to try to cover their tracks on that Breitbart investment really up until the time that the Senate, I believe it was, forced them to disclose it so that Breitbart could get White House press credentials. And that was one of those things where, you know, just a couple of years earlier, Breitbart was not thinking about what happens when we get White House press credentials. I mean,
right.
It just shows you what a weird timeline we're in. With the others, yeah, I mean, so all the people you mentioned are in the book, Loomer, Posobiec, there are many others. Jeff Giese is a kind of funding source for some of the people, but it's not clear that that's continuing. This is a guy who once worked with Peter Thiel and now kind of, he told me that he has funded some of this stuff in the past. But, you know, because a lot of this stuff is smaller scale, a lot of it works by working in concert and kind of being a kind of coordinated effort. It's not like there's one big, you know,
pile
big
of money.
Elephant in
right.
the room. Yeah. So sometimes it would be, you know, I mean, Milo had a, you know, a kind of mysterious Bitcoin millionaire who was going to be his benefactor. And then that guy died. And, you know, it's a lot of kind of random sources like this. Now, obviously, you know, I was tracking that stuff and I definitely put in, you know, things that I saw that were suggestive. I mean, I definitely and some of it, you know, some of it made it into the book. Some of it didn't. I mean, there was, you know, Cassandra Fairbanks, for example, would often sort of say that she was, you know, in constant touch with Julian Assange and she was going to visit him at the embassy where he was living and DMing with him. And, you know, she seemed on the one hand a little bit fearful about disclosing that, but on the other hand, you know, not that careful about it. So, you know, if Julian Assange is getting, you know, bankrolled by the Russians, then it's possible that people like Cassandra are too. And, you know, she has worked for Sputnik at various times. They also, but the thing that's so weird is that on the one hand, some of this stuff would be really shady and possibly criminal if it was exposed. On the other hand, because of this bizarre timeline we're in, you know, we see criminal activity every day from the White House that nobody seems to care about.
Right.
And if they don't care about it from the president, they're not really going to care about it from a, you know, third string neo-fascist. So it's like they can kind of just do it in broad daylight. I mean, I went to a Halloween party in D.C. with a bunch of the deplorables and, you know, some of them were dressing up. I mean, they're very catty with each other. Some of them are kind of dressing up as each other in kind of, you know, in kind of unkind ways. A lot of them had turned on Laura Loomer at that point, and some of them were dressed up in ways that were meant to mock her, which, you know, I'm not generally in the habit of, you know, of shedding a lot of tears for, you know, vicious Islamophobes like Laura Loomer. But, you know, I did feel bad for her in that moment. But then
was this before or after she chained herself to the front door of Twitter?
It was before she chained herself to the front door of Twitter, but it was after she pretended to get her tires slashed on her car. So right. there were multiple. And again, this is I try to, you know, sprinkle this stuff lightly throughout the book, because as you sort of said earlier, it's kind of, you know, in a sense, an ethnography of these people, but it's really using them as an example of the larger forces in our society.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot of drama and intrigue and rumor and all this stuff, but I tried to go easy on that stuff, because really all of these people could disappear from the face of the earth. And, you know, some of them in a sense have, I mean, Milo and Alex Jones, people like that, once they get wiped out by these platforms, their careers are really over. But I don't want people to rest easy and be complacent in the sense that, oh,
there's,
you know,
new ones growing every day. Right. Yeah, I mean, there's going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys have a short half-life, but the system that generates them, I think, is there.
Yeah. When the structural incentives are there, they're going to keep growing. But, you know, Cassandra dressed up as with a buddy, dressed up as Boris and Natasha, you know, and said, haha, you know, the joke is we're Russian spies. And I was like, is that a joke? Or, I mean, it, you know, you never really know. Some of this stuff is kind of tantalizing slash, you know, gaslighting if you take it too seriously. But yeah, I think to your larger point that what matters is the system that these platforms are building. It's less this or that individual, and, you know, should they be banned, or should they be sanctioned, or should they be quarantined, or, you know, should you leave them alone because free speech? Like, those are all, you know, debates we can have. But the larger debate is not about the you know, 18 individuals who are in this book. The larger debate is about, are we going to build a better structure so that we're not constantly in this snarl of informational crisis that we can't get out of? Are we going to actually, you know, create a movement to make these companies build better systems so that we don't constantly keep running into these problems?
Yeah, let's talk about those systems, because it seems to me that this is, there's a couple of things going on that allow for, you know, this type of stuff, fake news. I mean, particularly in the context of YouTube as well, that there is a that's two part. One, there is a huge financial incentive, right? I mean, it's not like, I mean, I think you start off by saying, like, they have this premise of free speech and how it's going to democratize everything. And to some extent, I think there is some truth to that. But it's also, we're building a machine that's going to print money, and the fuel for that printing money is going to be a lot of this stuff. And the game that I think these outlets are playing seems to be, how can we continue to put fuel into this money making machine and also make it seem to society that we're trying to curb that problem, which is actually driving a lot of the profits?
Yeah, and specifically the fuel of the machine, I think the central thing for people to keep in mind above all else is that these platforms run, as they're currently designed, around emotional engagement, at what social scientists call activating emotions. So it's not just, you know, if you have good content or if you, you know, really blow people's minds. There's a very specific way of doing this that has been studied by scientists and by, you know, content producers alike. And it's not like there's anything inherently wrong with getting people excited or wowing them, or, like, as you said earlier, it's not like there's anything really wrong with opinionated journalism that some people could call propaganda. That's not the problem. The problem is not that there are people with, you know, really colorful opinions out there. The problem is that these systems are built, it's not a level playing field. You know, they like to pretend that they're just sort of holding up a mirror to the national discourse, but they are warping the mirror. I mean, it's like a casino company saying, well, we're just providing a service because people really want to, you know, have fun playing on slot machines. But, like, that's obviously disingenuous. They've designed a whole system where, you know, they don't have windows, so you never know what time it is, and they pump the air full of oxygen, and they give you free drinks, and they do all these things to incentivize you to stay, even if you are a gambling addict who's going to lose your house because, you know, you can't find a way to get out of the casino. And then they turn around and say, well, you know, it's on you. You know, it's your free will that led you into this scenario. So it's not like individual agency has no role to play in this. Obviously, there are some people who are better at, you know, not having social media destroy them and warp their brains. But as a society, what it's doing to us collectively is pretty scary. So, you know, I think all things being equal, it's obviously better not to censor people and not to shut down speech. I mean, I'm a journalist. I really love the First Amendment. I, you know, all that sort of is stipulated. But it doesn't mean that because you love free speech, you don't pay attention to the incentives. And the incentives here are for people to spark the easiest lizard brain emotions they can, because those are the things that go viral. And when you have a system that's literally built around giving people more points if they are more scary or more titillating or more suggestive or more shocking, you're putting a finger on the scale.
I mean, is it possible to have these type of like behemoths essentially without that?
Yeah, totally. They would just maybe make a little bit less money. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, is it possible to have, you know, McDonald's, you know, source their potatoes more ethically and, you know, maybe make them, you know, not so terribly bad for you? It's possible. It just means that they might lose out on the competition to Burger King or whatever, and they just don't have any incentive to do it.
Well, that's what I mean, though, is that like, yes. And if I, you know, it's possible I could fly if I had wings. I mean, I'm asking if it's that type of scenario. Like, well, if a company that has the freedom to do what it's doing, is it possible, based upon the structure that we have, you want to call it capitalism or whatever, to actually do these things that are contrary to maximizing profit?
It's hard, right? I mean, given the way capitalism works, it's hard to move the needle on a big company. Now, I think, you know, the McDonald's analogy is maybe even less pointed than it should be, because it's almost like if McDonald's owned, you know, 98% of the market share instead of, you know, 60% or whatever they own. I don't know what the real numbers are, but, you know, it's like as if Wendy's and Burger King and all these other competitors right. were really, really, you know, so far down the chain. Look, I mean, you know, McDonald's serves more salads and things than they used to. I think you can move the needle that way by creating consumer demand and creating movements and, you know, making customers, you know, push for more things that they want. You know, you can also,
but can it come, I guess what I'm saying is, can it come from that direction, or does it have to be that there is, it is, we need to either make these companies fundamentally different in their structure through antitrust, or regulate them like we would, I don't know, you know, National Grid, but even more, I think, rigorous in some respects.
Yeah, I think that government definitely has a role. It's really tricky, right, because of the First Amendment. So you can't just have the government step in and have some, you know, ministry of truth that you know, tells people what is or isn't true. Obviously, nobody wants that. In a way, it's almost more like the food analogy, where you do have an FDA and it's hugely imperfect, but, you know, you are regulating to make sure that McDonald's can't put arsenic in their hamburgers, you know, or that, you know, if they have a salmonella outbreak, you know how to put that, you know, how to contain that and who to punish for it. So there's that basic level of just sort of safety and regulation, which we don't have on the internet. So that would be a good first step. And then there's also a cultural awareness. I mean, like, you know, maybe the better analogy here is the tobacco industry. Tobacco industry had no incentive to not, you know, addict everyone they could to cigarettes, including, you know, 9-year-olds, getting them hooked on bubblegum flavored, you know, vape pens or whatever. But the needle did move with the tobacco industry. Again, it's not perfect and the problem hasn't been solved. But I mean, there's been a huge amount of cultural progress in the last 20 years. Some of that has been from government regulation, but some of it has been, as you say, from the ground up, from just the cultural understanding that smoking is gross and it's not cool. Like, I don't want to be, but that, you know, naive from, about it.
But that came from basically proving that they had engaged in fraudulent practices, right? Like that they that came from a massive settlement funding. That cultural change came from funding from a massive settlement that was a function of proving that the tobacco executives knew that they were causing these deaths. And yeah, I don't know that we have that same. I mean, I guess maybe we could get to that point with a Google. I guess what I'm asking is, like, you know, when we talk about government regulation, like we could say, and I guess this is your food analogy, you need to stop using algorithms as a way of moderating in these different silos. If you want to use algorithms when it comes to, You know, and they do this, right? Like, I just saw some TikTok that was pulled down because a woman was pretending to do an eyelash video. And in between, you know, showing girls how to do thicker eyelashes with an eyelash scissors or whatever that is, she was talking about the Uyghurs in China and asking people to protest against that. And TikTok was able to pull it down. You know, I don't think
right. And that's an example of how that's an example of how scary things can get. And TikTok is owned by a Chinese company that has no respect for free speech at all. So this is where I think the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world have their best argument. And they make it a lot these days. You know, you'd rather have us doing it because if not, China's going to do it and they're going to do it with no respect to human rights. Now, I don't think that means that Mark Zuckerberg can just do whatever he wants. But I do think he's right in the sense that, you know, you don't want some, you know, dictatorial government with no accountability making these decisions. I certainly don't want the Trump administration making these decisions. So, you know, it's tricky, right? You don't want to just sort of say, okay, you know, everything that is bad gets shut down on the internet. I mean, I think obviously we can see what a slippery slope that leads to. I think, you know, I guess my thing when people bring up the slippery slope that I just brought up of, you know, well, if you censor one thing, aren't you going to censor everything else? I don't discount that, but I guess I just would like to raise the other slippery slope, which is what if you do let all these people speak? You know, people talk about if you censor Nazis' right to march in public, you know, you're going to censor me next. But like, what about the slippery slope that happens when you do let Nazis speak in public? I think it's worth worrying about both scenarios.
But don't,
maybe
but
it's just because I like worrying about everything. But
right. Yeah, no, yeah. I share that fear. But I mean, right now, let's be honest. I mean, we're on the slippery slope. There's never a time you're not. I mean, I can look at my YouTube numbers right now and I can see that over the past 6 to 8 months, the number of people who find my videos because they're subscribed to me versus the how YouTube suggests it to people has dramatically shifted. 8 months ago, 9 months ago, it was almost 50-50. In fact, 10 months ago, it was 60% suggested, 40% subscribers. It has more than flipped. It is now about 70-30. And that is because YouTube, when people are now looking for a specific topic, they'll go to MSNBC. They will YouTube will push MSNBC or CNN. I mean, any YouTube user, you know, has noticed this, that the corporate news medias are pushed forward. Prior to us. And so Google's already making that decision. They're just doing it on a different type of plane, right? Like they're just doing it on, based upon like what corporate sources are more reliable than independent sources in some way. Or, and you know, we're talking about, you know, it's not like there's a huge amount of reporting that we're talking about in these instances. A lot of it's commentary. And so the Google's already doing it, it seems to me. It's just a question of just like forcing them to use people, because a lot of it seems to me, and you would have a better sense of this having been in these offices, is that they don't want to spend the money or even set the precedent that they would have humans do this stuff who can make assessments that are a little bit more rational than machines.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, it's, you know, the sort of the tech mindset is, you know, humans aren't scalable. You know, they're annoying. You have to pay them. You have to give them bathroom breaks. It's like, it's much easier to just have, you know, machine learning or artificial intelligence do it. And yeah, as you are pointing out, there are huge limitations to what artificial intelligence can do. I mean, obviously people aren't perfect either. There's no perfect solution to any of this, but humans have to be involved at some level. And that is an inefficiency or a friction point, you know, to use the tech terminology for it, which, you know, again, like this is where I do think that sort of basic expectations matter of these companies. Part of it is a structural thing just in the sense of how big they are. Like this is where I think there's a lot to be said for the kind of, you know, Elizabeth Warren / Louis Brandeis way of thinking about the curse of bigness. Like, you know, Google making its own unilateral decisions, as you say, it's sort of just the company doing it on its own. But one thing that makes that, if not unique, then really unusual, is that they are just such a quasi-monopolistic power that it's almost like, you know, and this is a case with Amazon too, and in many cases it's the case with Facebook too, that, you know, by biasing, they own so much of the infrastructure that by biasing the infrastructure, they're really warping things more than any other company would be able to. So it's not only like McDonald's changing its menu. It's like McDonald's owning the roads and being able to suggest which exit you get off and then putting a McDonald's right at that exit. I mean, it's like a much huger chunk of the infrastructure that they're able to control. So I think in that sense, there's a good argument for breaking some of these companies up. But I also don't think that antitrust action, even if it could be taken, would get you all the way there. I mean, Facebook has already been fined $5 billion by the FTC last year. It was the biggest fine in FTC history. And immediately the analysis was like, oh, not a big deal. Facebook will pay that without blinking.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think there's government action that could be huge and unprecedented and could be still not enough. And this is where, you know, people sort of think of it as kind of, you know, soft-headed or naive or whatever to talk about cultural change. And I see that. But I also think that cultural change is a huge part of this. I mean, it's a feedback mechanism, right? You have governmental change because you have cultural change and vice versa. And so I think part of it is, you know, when I was sitting in the offices of some of these companies, sometimes they would make decisions because if we don't do this, we're going to get sanctioned by the government. But often it would be, we're going to get hit really hard in the press, we're going to have users defect, or we're just going to feel like lepers and pariahs when we go walk around San Francisco. I mean, you know, don't forget, like, these people care a lot about their legacies. These tech bros, they, you know, I call them sort of riffing on the Michael Lewis term for bankers. I call them big swinging brains in the book. I mean, they really want to be seen as the brainiest, most luminary, most forward thinking people. They want their names on buildings. They want to have great legacies, like, you know, Bill Gates, the philanthropist. And so that's not the only leverage point, but I really think we underestimate what a leverage point that is, the kind of appealing to their ego and their desire to be seen as vectors for positive social change. And if everyone in the world thinks that you are on the wrong side of history, that's a powerful motivating force to do something better. I'm not naive enough to think that that's all you need, but I think we discount it too much sometimes.
I guess we'll find out. I prefer to see them all just split up into very small pieces, but and I think it'll be easier at that point for any cultural changes to happen. The book is Antisocial: Online Extremists, Techno Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. Andrew Morantz, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head to the fun half of the program. Folks should read the book. I could have talked to them for a long time. Apparently, a lot of those folks who were the neo-fascists, and I think he has categories of people in the book that that run from, let's see, alt-right to alt-light to full-on Nazis. And he says a lot of these people actually came from, which is not to say, I don't want anybody to over-interpret this, but that's a lot of these people come from the libertarian anti-war movement, and they became a little bit disenchanted with Trump for this. A lot of those people have gone to Tulsi. Now, you know,
damn.
That's I don't know that means anything other than that it's a description of where these people are at. But
well, there is a difference between being an isolationist and an anti-imperialist.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. Interesting stuff, and it is the near 1 year anniversary or 2 year, I should say, I guess now, Mike Cernovich. I don't know where Cernovich is now. I guess he's making documentaries and presenting them on Dave Rubin's Blaze show. I'm not sure, but
who's laughing now, Sam?
I still am. Folks, a reminder, this show relies on you for its support. Not on the Mercers, Not on those other dudes. Not on my ex-wife's Facebook stock options. It relies on you, our audience. So you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. I feel like I should put a new membership level, which is my ex-wife's not a Facebook executive level. But I don't know. That seems a little cumbersome. I don't think that would fit on a t-shirt. But you can go to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support this program. You get extra content. You get the free show without commercials. And you get the that warm, fuzzy feeling of supporting this program. Also, don't forget to sign up for the AM Quickie. You can do so at amquickie.com, or you can just get the Majority Report app. And it is living now, the AM Quickie, in addition to the Majority Report, live on the Majority Report app. You can check it out at majorityapp.com. Also, Just Coffee, Dot Co-op, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. Normally, I would tell you to use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off, but now you don't need to for this up until near Christmas time. I'm not sure how long it's going, but 30% off as we speak. Great time to try various types of Just Coffee. Go in, maybe buy a 5-pound bag or do a bunch of 1-pound bags. Try out the Majority Report. Try some other blends. All at justcoffee.coop. Today is Tuesday. However, it's not a normal Tuesday because of what happened last night. Michael.
We had a really amazing TMBS last night. I'm very proud of what we're doing. We had on the great Nina Turner. That was incredibly fun and inspiring, obviously, as anybody who's familiar with her work in politics or on the campaign trail. And then Milton Alamadi, who's the founder and publisher of Black Star News, returned. We talked about the competing colonial visions between the United States, France, and China in the continent of Africa, and how that relates to Samir Amin's work on building a post-colonial world. And we did an illicit history of the NATO invasion of Libya. We talked about the UK elections. We did a lot. Go watch the full show on the Michael Brooks Show channel on YouTube and get everything, including this weekend's primer on housing justice and the Green New Deal with Megan Day, patreon.com/TMBS.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, Sean and Andy went across the pond and recorded an episode with the lads and lass of Trash Future, which is a very funny podcast out of London. They talk about the upcoming UK elections, the deep insecurities at the center of posh life, which are motivating Boris Johnson's political career, the Lib Dem and Chuck cucks, and Corbyn's cheeky plan to nationalize Nando's and put Mr. Bean on the dole. Also, we have a bonus.
They love Nando's over there.
I don't even know what that is. I'm just reading the description that Sean wrote.
I love it. Nationalizing it would be a big deal.
All right. Cool. We also released a patron bonus for all of our wonderful subscribers on Friday. It is a real Lib Dem Hours, also with Trash Future, wherein they read a dystopian fanfic by one James Kirkup called How the Lib Dems Could Seize Power, and they have a little bit of fun with it. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
And check out Matt's podcast, Literary Hangover, at patreon.com/literary hangover. Matt has himself an actual hangover, and so he's not in today. All right, folks, quick break. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich. I haven't.